On today's episode, my special guest is Adam Hayden. Adam is a patient advocate, writer, philosopher from Indianapolis, and he's also going to be the host of a special screening of the amazing short documentary Endgame, which was nominated for an Oscar last year. We'll have more information on that. I'm Richard Brendan. You're listening to Journey's Fire. Thank you for joining me today. Adam is a trained philosopher of science, a guy in his mid-30s. He's married. He's a father of three adorable boys. And also, he's on a journey fighting glioblastoma, which is an incurable grade 4 primary brain tumor. Adam's here to talk about that, also his passion for being an advocate for healthcare. Adam Hayden, it's so good to have you back in the studio.
Oh, it's terrific to be back with you.
I am excited about an event that you have put together, actually, and I love the story behind it, but it's going to be coming up November 3rd, and you're going to be featuring Endgame documentary, which, by the way, was nominated for an Oscar, a short film, I believe,
yes.
Just this past year. Didn't win, but it should have. It was so well done.
It is a terrific documentary that just casts a light in a really kind of concise and mm-hmm. clear way. The considerations, weighing values at the end of life, and, you know, the professional acumen of our palliative and hospice medicine clinicians. Mm-hmm. It's a terrific documentary.
Yeah. Now, this show is airing Sunday, and it's going to be a week from Sunday. It's going to be November 3rd. It's going to be held at the Thunderbird in Fountain Square. The time is from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. The thing is, you just found out that it's sold out.
That's right.
Yeah. So if people are really hyped after listening to this, they really can't go to this event now because it's sold out. But I'm guessing you'll have more events down the road.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you invited me to share about what could be on the horizon. That's exactly right. That there was a quick response to this event, which surprised me, but pleasantly surprised me that we reached 90 registrations really quickly. And the owner of the Thunderbird, you know, he says if we have any more than that, the fire marshal may come.
And so, yeah. And why did you choose the Thunderbird?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, I think that these end of life conversations, they either happen in one of two places. One are in sort of niche communities that I think that the public may not know the entry point into some of these death cafes and death salons. These death positive movements can mm-hmm. be a little bit intimidating to the public. I think the other venue for these conversations is in an institutional setting. So whether that's in medical education or in the, you know, palliative medicine service of a large hospital. But I wanted to provide an opportunity for people to just come as you are, order a beer if you want to, mm-hmm. and let's have real conversation with real people in a relaxed setting.
Yeah. So why Endgame? For those people who aren't familiar with that, and by the way, there's also an Endgame movie out. I think there's a podcast called Endgame. Share the importance of this film and what it's about.
Yeah, the Endgame documentary, which is important when you're searching Google, because you might arrive at the Endgame blockbuster film. and so I won't remark on that. Endgame documentary, you know, I think I really applaud Shoshana Ungerleiter, who will talk about the executive producer of the film. Mm-hmm. And I found this film. So I was diagnosed with brain cancer, and we may discuss that a bit, but that was in 2016. So it was more than 3 years ago. On this 3-year journey, you know, it's a really grim prognosis that I was given 3 years ago. So I became interested in, well, I do have this limited or abbreviated timeline. So how do I maximize my time while I'm here? I'm married. I have young kids. So I'm interested in these conversations about, you know, how do we live and die in a very human way? So scrolling Netflix, I came across this documentary, Endgame, and I thought, well, this looks really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. So one night after the kids went to bed, I turned this on, and I sobbed through the mm-hmm. film. It immediately gripped me and spoke to me where I am today. But I aired it with my wife a few nights later, and it kind of met her where she was, not living with a difficult diagnosis, loving someone who is. But I thought, you know, all of us have loved someone through illness and maybe through death, mm-hmm. You know, whether that's grandparents or our own parents. So I thought this film speaks to people where they are.
Yeah, Yeah. And you've also assembled an impressive list of people on a committee that's going to be, you're going to be moderating that, I believe, or someone else will, I think, in terms of discussion after the film. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah. So I think, you know, we have this kind of interprofessional panel is the way I'd like to call it. Mm-hmm. But these are, so we have representatives from medicine. So we have a physician, a palliative medicine physician who will be there, but also a professor from religious studies, a mm-hmm. professor from medical humanities. We have a chaplain. A reverend who is also in charge of spiritual education, so a chaplain who trains other chaplains. We have a psychologist, and a psychologist who has done a lot of work with the Simon Cancer Center here in Indianapolis, as well as other palliative care services in the city. And then we have a CEO of a nonprofit that runs a hospice home for folks who don't have a home of their own.
Yes.
Which is a neat thing.
I believe that's the Abby Bryce home.
Yes. Yep.
It's
that's
been
right.
there. It's beautiful. And they do good work there, too.
Yep.
What was your vision when you came up to this? And what's the takeaway that you hope by the time the evening's over and people go home, that it spurs conversation then not only within a group that was there, but also with other people from those who've seen it?
Yes. Yeah. So I think I was extended this platform as a young person. I was diagnosed with this difficult brain cancer diagnosis at 34 years old. So I was extended a platform because people said, hey, you're a seemingly healthy 34-year-old guy. And then you get this thing handed to you. What do you do with it? And so you get all these comments that become, you know, kind of the cliche response. Yeah. People will say, well, I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. And it's like, well, sure, you could. Mm-hmm. But of course, I know the number of my bus that's coming. I just don't know if it's on time, you know. Mm-hmm. So I thought we need to elevate the conversation around end of life. So I thought, let's bring people together and let's have the clinicians and let's have the professionals, but then let's also have the patients like me and let's have just everybody off the street. Let's come into a comfortable setting and let's see how we can deepen relationships when we remove the credentials and we remove the institutional setting and we just are left with each other.
Yeah, so let's dive into that now because I was going to ask the setup question that said, Adam, how does a bartender with a master's in philosophy become a powerful voice in death and dying, and also restoring heart and soul and health care to medical professionals across the country. Mm. You just answered that. The diagnosis.
A diagnosis, absolutely.
Take us back to that time. You must have been having symptoms that led up to seeing the doctor, or?
Yeah, and in fact, the first symptom, which it was a symptom, but we didn't quite know to call it that. Came just after the holidays in 2014, just before 2015, when I had a strange dizziness episode and some loss of motor function on the left side of my body. Now, that sounds kind of fancy, but I just kind of crumpled down to the ground. I didn't lose consciousness. I didn't convulse. It was none of that. I was dizzy and lightheaded, and I needed to go down to the ground. That happened at late 2014, and I didn't think much about it. You know, I think the stereotypical guy response, I don't need to go to the doctor.
Right.
I'm healthy. I'm fine. But then it happened again in March, you know, a few months later, and I thought, well, this is interesting. So I did follow up with a clinician, and we thought, well, maybe it's vertigo. And so for the following year, it was about 15 months in total that I would see specialists, and we would eliminate diagnoses, but we wouldn't confirm a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And eventually, these episodes, they reached the point where they were happening daily, and they were intense, and they were debilitating by the end. And so my general practitioner said, we need to get you into an MRI.
Yeah.
And that MRI set it up. We had that scan, and it turned out that I had a 7-centimeter mass in my brain. That's about the diameter of a baseball, a large mass. So then we were off to the races, you know, 15 months of questionable symptoms. And then you get a scan like that, an MRI like that. And very quickly you're meeting with a neurosurgeon and an oncologist. And then came the diagnosis.
And you had surgery?
And awake, a brain surgery, an awake craniotomy. Mm-hmm. So quite an experience that was.
I bet that was.
Yeah.
So what happened after the surgery then? Was there some progress?
Yeah, so following surgery, the location of the tumor, the mass, the tumor that was in my brain, it does affect kind of spatial awareness, motor function, sensory input on the opposite side of my body. So the tumor was on the right, that was on the left. Mm-hmm. So coming out of surgery, I was in really rough shape. In fact, I was in a wheelchair, had really limited mobility throughout the left side of my body, hands and arm and everything. So I was discharged from the hospital into an acute rehab facility. So I spent about a month in the hospital just trying to recover. So, you know, could I give myself a bath? Could I eat? Can I dress myself? So the mm-hmm. first month after surgery, it was intense occupational and physical therapy. And then it was during that time that we received the diagnosis of glioblastoma. Yeah. So it is a brain cancer, and there was radiation and chemotherapy. And gosh, it was a year of just really intense chemo, radiation, occupational physical therapy continued. Mm-hmm. For that first year, you're just kind of head down, just trying to make it through treatment and trying to orient yourself in the world.
With the background I've had in hospice and also the almost daily practice of death meditation that I try to do, death awareness, I have not had a doctor look at me and say, you're terminal, and let alone show me the results of a tumor. What was that like for you? What emotionally, what were you thinking? And also Whitney, your wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think something that I like to lift up here is that, you know, we have the words, language that we use, but not all language is verbal. So when we received the diagnosis, the oncology nurse who was in the office with us, with the oncologist and my wife and myself, as the oncologist spoke, the nurse reached from her chair and grabbed my hand and my wife's hand in each of her hands and just squeezed. And that spoke to us two things. One, this is really serious, because if you have the flu, they're not going to hold your hand. So we knew it was very serious, but we also felt comfort and support in that moment. And I think that that set the tone for all the months and now years to follow, that we have a care team that supports us. Despite the seriousness of the diagnosis, we can still move forward. And Whitney, she is my champion, my advocate, my best friend. She has about 12 years of experience in healthcare. Mm-hmm. She works at a level one trauma center. So my wife, if it has happened to people in healthcare, likely my wife has witnessed some part of it.
Yeah.
So I think for her, it was quieting the professional perspective that she had mm-hmm. and allowing the emotional and personal to shine through that.
How old were the boys then?
Yeah, they were 4, 2, and 8 months old.
Oh.
Yeah, young boys.
When or how did you begin to speak with them about this? Did you do it individually based on their age, or how did you handle that?
Yeah, so being in the hospital for about a month, of course, I wanted to see my kids. So Whitney would bring them up to me. And because it was a significant surgery, I had about 40 surgical staples in my head. And, you know, you can't hide staples. The boys knew immediately something is up with Dad. Mm-hmm. So we started talking about it as Dad's brain boo-boo. We became involved with National Brain Tumor Society pretty early on. So as our oldest, Isaac, really sharp kid, as he started to put letters together and start to pronounce words, we had a lot of National Brain Tumor Society swag around the house from mm-hmm. events that we had been to. Mm-hmm. And so Isaac was already understanding, well, we're talking about Daddy's brain boo-boo, and I see these words, brain tumor. So his kind of mental gears were turning. We enrolled him in a camp for kids whose parents or guardians have or had cancer, Camp Kesem. And he was accepted to that camp. And we thought, well, this is it's a cancer camp, essentially. Yeah. So we've got to tell him. It can't just be brain boo-boo or brain mm-hmm. tumor. We've got to really connect the dots for Isaac before he goes away on this camp. And so we sat him down, and we sat him down in our living room. And we have pictures of family on kind of a picture wall in mm-hmm. the living room, as mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. And there are pictures of relatives that, you know, are up the road from us, but also relatives that have since passed away.
Yeah.
So that became the reference point to share with Isaac, the brain boo-boo that Daddy has is actually brain cancer. Mm-hmm. And we looked at pictures on the wall, and we said, you know, Daddy may not to live to be an old man like some of the pictures of our family members that you see on the wall.
Yeah.
But we know that our family is still with us, and Dad will be with us as well. Mm-hmm. So we started that conversation with Isaac and his younger brothers. They were around, but not yet you know, really fully conceptualizing that.
Yes.
But Isaac has really helped be a leader for his brothers as they get older and kind of learn what's happening in our family.
Wow, what a spiritual warrior he is.
Well, I often wonder, I hope we're not putting too much on the little guy, but
yeah.
he's along with us. I don't want to shield him.
Yeah, yeah. So what is your diagnosis? What stage is the cancer in?
It is a grade 4 cancer. So there are different grades. So grading and staging, a little bit different terminology in the world of brain versus other cancers, but it is the most aggressive brain cancer that you can get.
And you've had that for a while now, that grade.
Yes, over 3 years, which is incredible. I mean, the median survival for this disease is about 18 months. Mm-hmm. So I have now, you know, doubled that, plus a little bit. So it's a strange, you know, we know that there are some good things. I was overall healthy and young coming into this.
Yes.
So that helps.
Yes.
And
but there would be people, Adam, who get a diagnosis perhaps like that. And without any apologies, I mean, cave in, give up, feel sorry for themselves, want to stop doing everything or anything. And you kind of went the opposite direction. What was it in you that said, no, if I'm going to go out, I'm going out in a flame, and I want to get my voice out there and share with people what's going on?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that I understand the urge to go underground, and I give myself periods of time where I just disengage. And if I don't give myself permission to disengage for a little while, I very quickly feel my emotional resiliency just fall away.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I did go in a different direction. And in fact, while I was still recovering in the hospital, I sent an email to a former professor of mine who works in medical humanities. And I said, I've got a story to tell, and I want you to help me tell it. Mm. So right away, I knew I wanted to share this experience. Mm. And I think part of that was receiving care on a brain trauma unit. That's where I had that intensive physical therapy. Mm. Being on a brain trauma unit is really a frightening place because you are with people, traumatic brain injuries, a lot of brain trauma. I was the only guy with a brain tumor on that floor, but there's a bed alarm, a wheelchair alarm, the doors are locked at either end of the corridor. And I felt like, man, I've got a voice and some people here do not. Mm-hmm. And so I have an obligation to raise that voice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And how do you take care of yourself? You must be through nutrition, a lot of sleep, because you're traveling a lot, it seems like.
Yeah.
I follow you on Twitter, too. It seems like you're everywhere when you pop up.
Well, that's nice of you to say. It is, and candidly, it's becoming more difficult. Okay. I think earlier on in the journey, I could pick up and go and mm-hmm. be okay. Now, mm-hmm. there's kind of an equation. I mean, it's not a perfect science, but if I'm on the road for a week, it'll be another 3 weeks or so before I feel well again.
Yeah.
I think daily self-care, what am I up to? There is a nutritional component. So I do, you know, it's a pretty low-carb diet, mm-hmm. and I don't eat much processed stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that plays a role. I think really our three boys getting up every single day, and they don't, of course, they care a lot about dad, but they don't care about what kind of shape you're in. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, I want my oatmeal.
Absolutely.
Get up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. When you speak, especially a lot of these medical groups across the country, as you have, what is your primary message? I get a sense it's like restoring heart and soul in medicine.
Yes.
Okay.
You said it.
Okay.
I mean, so I think that's as far back as Hippocrates. You know, a lot of people know the Hippocratic Oath, or at least they're aware of that being a thing. Hippocrates, you know, he really talked about, you know, it's really important to understand the person.
Yeah.
It's not what disease, you know, that somebody's got that matters. It's what kind of person they are that has the disease. Hippocrates told us that, you know, 2,000 years ago, William Osler said at the turn of the 20th century, it's a good physician that treats the disease. It's the great physician that treats the patient with the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So medicine itself it's a humanistic science. And that sounds like it can be sort of an oxymoron for people, but that's not the case. I think that medicine comes from humanity. It is an art. It is a practice. And I think we've become too rigid.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm not picking on evidence-based medicine. I'm not picking on the biomedical model of science. They have eradicated diseases, so we need to applaud that work. But in the effort to cure things, we forgot about caring for people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm up to.
I have witnessed that myself, not only in hospitals, but also in assisted livings and nursing homes, in which I went in as a hospice worker. But I'm wondering, for you, what do you think the cause is for that, and how do you turn that around? to bring it back to where it should have been all along.
Yeah, I think that, we love to quantify and measure things, don't mm-hmm. we? So it is, you know, your work week is this many hours and your salary is this much money. And so I think in medicine, we have started to quantify. If you look for metrics, it is things like progression-free survival, overall survival. And so when we begin to quantify and measure and we start to ask about someone's values, someone's goals, that's hard to measure. Yeah. I care about family. Well, I can't put a number to that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the low-hanging fruit of the things that we can measure and quantify and track progress over time.
Yeah. Something I'm excited for you is, I believe later this year, and maybe in December, Endwell is what I call the death and dying of TED Talks. I mean, it is really becoming more and more popular. I think it's in various cities now, perhaps San Francisco, New York, maybe.
Yeah, the road to Endwell at these smaller pop-up events that are happening throughout the year.
Yeah,
it's exciting.
You've been selected to be one of the speakers for this year.
Correct.
Where will that be held?
So the Endwell Symposium in San Francisco, California, in early December of this year.
Okay. And I'm going to toss you a softball, but who are you on stage with?
Yeah, you know, I am. It's exciting. So Tim McGraw is going to be speaking this year. Megan McCain will be reflecting. She'll be giving a talk this year. Yeah. And someone who's a really big name in narrative medicine and medical education, Lucy Kalanithi, whose mm-hmm. late husband Paul Kalanithi wrote the memoir When Breath Becomes Air. Mm. So Lucy will be there as well.
Wow. And what will your message be?
Yes, I am talking, it's on the, I think, on the themes of what I'm up to. Generally, I'm talking about solidarity and humanity, mm-hmm. that it's wrong to say there are healthy people and sick people. It's wrong to say there are doctors and patients. Really, we are all human, mm-hmm. and that we might be in a different state of being at a different point in our life, mm-hmm. But all of us are connected through our shared humanity. And what do we have in common through the shared humanity? Well, we live and we die.
Yeah. What sustains you through all this?
Yeah, you know, it is the feeling that I'm making a difference, mm-hmm. I think. And mm-hmm. so it is what sustains me are capturing eye contact. When Noah, our middle child, mm-hmm. that boy is expressive. And when I see the smile on his face, that sustains me. But I also see smiles like that when I gave a grand rounds, which is a talk in a medical setting recently, to a group of neurologists. And they were in their white coats. And a couple of them, I got that eye contact look. Mm-hmm. And I could tell they were hearing me, not just listening, but something was sort of landing. Mm-hmm. It's that spark of, yes, I see you.
Yeah. Yeah, I know how we all follow our own paths, and especially we all follow our own spiritual paths. Your father is a minister.
Yes.
First of all, how are your parents doing with all of this?
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, I think they support us in tremendous ways. So they have showed up for us. Mm-hmm. I don't drive because of seizures, epilepsy, I guess easier to write than say. So my folks, they provide transportation, they watch the kids, they look after me. Yeah. So they're very supportive. I think something that I reflect on often is that I get the attention because I'm the one going through it. But family members are they like to call cancer folks survivors. Mm-hmm. I don't love that all the time because mm-hmm. Thus far I haven't survived anything. I'm just sort of going through it. But I like this terminology of if I'm a survivor, then the family, they're the secondary survivors.
Okay.
My folks continue to do the good work that they do. My dad is still at the same church now 25 plus years as a senior pastor.
Yeah. How would you describe your spirituality?
It is grounded in relationship and love. Mm-hmm. I look to, so I'm educated in the Abrahamic tradition through my mm-hmm. upbringing. Mm-hmm. I think, Sarah and Abraham, they were building an open tent for people to come in from all sides. Jesus said the great commandment is love. Yeah. So that's my faith is in relationship.
Yeah. And Ziggy Marley said, love is my religion.
Perfect.
So have you thought about, with all the talks you're doing, I'm sure most of them are taped, putting it in book form?
I am working on a book right now, in fact.
So, I was hoping you would say that.
Yes. I've been blogging for, a couple of years now.
Yes, you have.
And what I thought, this naive Adam, I thought, well, I can just pull out some blog content and stitch it together and we'll have a book. And it turns out, no, that's not the case. I think the format of a blog is a little more episodic and, you can write 800, 1,000 words, and it's a one hit and done, and you post it. A book really needs, kind of a meta-narrative to sustain it. But I'm really enjoying the process. It's tough because I'm revisiting things that I thought I had sort of closed the door behind me. So going back to thinking about what really was surgery like in a way that I can describe it to a reader who has never been in an operating room. Mm-hmm. So returning to those events can be difficult, but also, I have more, the hindsight is 20/20. So yeah. They illuminate learnings for me in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. So how's the process going, the writing process?
Yeah. So I'm about, 80,000 words, which I know doesn't mean anybody if you're not a writer, but 80,000 of about 110,000 word target is kind of what I'm aiming towards.
You're close.
So I'm getting close.
Yeah. Yeah. You care to share a title with us, or are you going to keep that quiet for a while?
Well, I think as long as the editors would allow it, this is what I'm realizing is that, the author only gets so much influence in the process. Uh-huh. But the title that I've been playing with is also what I use for my blog, which is A Glioblastology, A Philosopher Documents His Battle with Brain Cancer.
That's powerful and to the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Speaking of blog, talk about your website. I'd like to direct our listeners to that.
Great. So glioblastology.com. It is kind of a mashup here. So glioblastoma is my diagnosis, mm-hmm. and we know from kind of that suffix, ology is a study of. Mm-hmm. So glioblastology, I thought, was a clever little title for it. So the blog has been a great peer-to-peer resource for people. It's really surprised me. So here's a great anecdote, and this happened 3 days ago, maybe four now, 3 or 4 days ago. Uh-huh. I woke up, checked my email in the morning. There was an email that came through at 4:53 a.m., mm-hmm. and it was from a woman who had spent the night in the ER. Mm. And she went for a scan the day before that she thought she was having TMJ. Mm-hmm. So they did some x-ray and CT stuff to try to diagnose TMJ. What they found was a brain tumor. So she was quickly rushed to the emergency room. She spent the night in the ER Googling what it could be. Yeah. And through that process, found my blog, sent me an email after an all-nighter in the ER, sent me this email at 4:50 in the morning and said, I found your blog. I read some things. I'm really scared. What can you tell me?
Wow.
So to wake up to that is both, it speaks to why sometimes I've got to pull back, because that's tough.
Yeah.
But it also, what a privilege and opportunity that I have to meet someone at the beginning of their journey and to meet them from a place of some knowledge and some comfort and compassion.
Well, and it clearly shows why you are still needed on this earth plane right now, because you are bringing hope. And I'd like to think you're also creating a spark of a revolution in the medical community, too, because you're living an example of we all need to be treated as humans. Mm. We need to get back to that, because I have to believe everybody going into any helping profession has that heart. It's just somewhere along the line, we've kind of lost it a little bit.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think that people came to medicine to do the good work of healing.
Yeah.
And what there's a person who works in narrative medicine, and if folks are interested in that field, they'll know this person, Rita Sharon. Mm-hmm. And Rita Sharon said that medical education, it tells the young medical student that what is beneath their white coat doesn't matter to the practice of being a physician, which of course is not the case, because we all, again, humanity, we have that in common.
Yeah. So coming up November 3rd, Adam Hayden, an evening in partnership with the Endwell Foundation. I believe the directors of the film are going to be there as well. Is that right?
We're going to have a virtual drop-in from Shoshana Ungerleiter will be there to give us kind of a kickoff at the beginning of the event.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, because I found out she is a rock star now.
She is a rock star. She absolutely is, yes. And fame or not, Academy Award or not, she is a terrific, inspirational leader.
Well, people listen to this through iTunes or probably anywhere in the world. But being in Indianapolis myself, I want to thank you for creating this, because when you do it, I know it's going to be well done and well thought out, and it is, because you bring heart and mind to everything you do. You're also working on that book, so I'm glad to hear that. Also, do you have thoughts about other events you might want to do? Because you do a great job of putting these together.
Well, thanks for that.
You seem to be a good connector, too, with people.
Yeah, that was this idea that what smart people do is they hire people that are smarter than them to be in the room. I think I've tried. That's my networking, is that, wow, you know a lot more than I do. Will you come and help me?
Yeah.
So there is an annual fundraiser that my wife and I do for National Brain Tumor Society. That's at a restaurant, Reverie, in Greenwood, Indiana. So the third year of that will be coming up around April of 2020. Mm-hmm. We've done a great job having a lot of fun live music and raising a lot of money. In 2020, I think because we sold out this event you're speaking about on the third so quickly, and also it's at a bar, so we're excluding an all-ages population.
True.
We've had a request to what could we do to include everybody. So yeah. I've already started, again, networking, talking to some folks.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. Also, share your web address. And if you have to spell it, please spell it
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. So it is glioblastology.com, GLIOBLASTOLOGY.com.
Adam Hayden, it's always a delight to be in your presence. I follow your work through Twitter, through Facebook. Looking forward to seeing you myself at the Thunderbird. And thank you for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
I want to encourage you to visit Adam online. His website is glioblastology.com. That's GLIOBLASTOLOGY.com. And in closing, I'd like to share this poem from the great poet Mary Oliver. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from her purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like? That cottage of darkness. And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, toward silence. And each body, a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was the bride, married to amazement. I was the bridegroom, taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. And that's today's program. Reminder that all shows are podcast on the website, richardbrendon.com. And so for engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendon. You've been listening to Journey's Fire, a voice on the art of living, loving, and dying.